Emily is 45, with memorable, glowing skin, clear and unmarked, small in stature, with a generous mouth and pretty teeth like white corn. Her hair is entirely gray, unusual in someone her age. When she smiles, it's easy to imagine her at 20. Smiling now, she removes a snapshot of a young woman with prematurely gray hair from her purse and places it facing me on the table. "My daughter, Jean," she says proudly. It is the first picture she's ever had of Jean, and only the second time she's seen her daughter's face since the moment a quarter of a century earlier when a door had been locked between them. Prior to labor, Emily had signed a placement agreement at the adoption agency where I used to work. I am writing a book about the need for adoption reform, and I have traveled to the Southwest to meet with her. In earlier days, long before I worked there, Emily had been an agency client in 1965. The adoption agency's doors had been kept open by the income earned from adoptions by childless couples who wanted babies like Emily's daughter, Jean. Jean was a desirable child to obtain. She was white. African American families were not even served by this agency. She was an infant, not an older child. She was a, quote, blue ribbon baby. Her, quote, alleged father was described in the agency file in terms more suitable for a kennel as Irish, Belfast descent, 6 feet tall, blue-eyed, medium build, long-boned, healthy, medium brown hair, green eyes, a talented painter, a college student, and musician. And her mother, Emily, as a college student, attractive and intelligent. The services offered now in a different era by this adoption agency, child welfare agency now, at which I was newly employed, included foster care and adoption services for older children, most of whom were African American, and help to its former clients, the adult adoptees and birth mothers who wanted to find one another. I had been assigned Emily and Jean's case. My social work education had included nothing about adoption. I had, like most people, an unexamined belief that adoption was inherently a good thing, that it was about finding a safe and loving home for a child who desperately needed one. Prior to becoming a social worker, back in New Hampshire, I'd written a four-part newspaper series on child abuse and neglect. Then, as a social work graduate student intern in Chicago, I'd provided counseling and home visits to families under court order for abuse and neglect. I'd also written a pamphlet for the National Committee for the Prevention of Child Abuse about child sexual abuse. I was wary of inalienable parental rights. I had stood in juvenile court, a place guaranteed to make anyone's heart ache, and listened to a judge order a 3-year-old boy to have unsupervised weekend visits with the mother who'd inflicted bruises on his face and body and refused to give him water when he was sick. He had deteriorated into a coma and nearly died, yet visits had been justified on the grounds of family preservation. It was nearly impossible to terminate the parental rights of that child's mother and father. The court was hopelessly overloaded. The state caseworker might or might not prepare papers properly. Witnesses might or might not show up. A public defender would be assigned to protect the parents' rights, a guardian ad litem to protect the child's. Hearings would be scheduled and canceled and rescheduled. Years could pass while children across the country could live like the Cabbage Patch Dolls, so popular at that time, in foster care until it was too late to be adopted. Or they would be returned home, perhaps to be further harmed, sometimes even killed. But Emily and Jean's story and the scores of stories I read about in agency files and listened to from birth mothers and adult adoptees that I interviewed outside of the agency were not about abuse and neglect. The babies here had not been in desperate need of a safe and loving home. Their mothers had not been abusive or neglectful. They were simply unmarried. After I'd seen how hard it was to terminate parental rights in juvenile court, I was shocked by the ease with which these same rights were ended through adoption. No public defender here for the young women who were condemned by society for being unmarried. No guardian ad litem for the babies who were separated forever from their mothers. Young women like Emily, guided only by the mores of a society which judged them unfit because of their marital status, and the advice of adoption caseworkers employed to find babies for childless couples, had by merely signing their names in a moment of great emotional stress and vulnerability forever and irrevocably lost their children. And their children, like Jean, had lost their mothers. The basement storerooms of this century-old agency still had an ancient card file with the names handwritten in a spidery, old-fashioned style of forgotten babies, long since grown up, long since dead, and numerous locked filing cabinets. These were off-limits to everyone except top staff. They held the files of famous people, I was told, or the adoptions by staff members or people who were on the board of directors. All the other files, thousands of them, were in warehouses, and at the time I worked there, were also overflowing several empty offices. The only two longtime employees who held the mysteries of the storage and retrieval system in their heads were on medical leave. No one else was quite sure where all the files were or how to get to them. And every day at lunch, the kind-hearted woman who answered the phone requests from adoptees and their mothers told me of the ceaseless calls and her frustration at having to put them on waiting lists of over a year, perhaps unable to tell adoptees if their adoption had even taken place here. But I had been easily able to find Emily and Jean's case file because it was stored on site, having been opened many times over the past 25 years. Emily had repeatedly sent birthday cards in case they could ever be delivered, and had even visited here to inquire about her daughter. Opening Emily and Jean's file was like falling down a rabbit hole into someone else's most private life and past. Here was Jean's original birth certificate, her amended birth certificate, on which Emily's name had vanished and the adoptive parent's name been inserted. Here was the card sent by her adoptive family to the agency caseworker the first Christmas following Jean's adoption. A few baby photos, a doctor's report soon after birth, healthy, white female, a verbatim account of the caseworker's few meetings and phone calls with Emily. Still fastened with tape to the manila folder was Jean's hospital baby bracelet. I could read information forbidden to the people to whom it belonged, and what I read revealed both the lack of any meaningful help given to Emily and the agency's transparent desire for her baby. Jean, that baby, now 25 years old, had made persistent phone calls to the agency, which resulted in the assigning of her case to me and eventually our finding her birth mother, Emily. From our first phone conversation, Jean was hungry to get every scrap of information she could about her mother. Each fact, no matter how ordinary, was a revelation to her. She told me that she felt she had no history. She'd never even known her ethnicity. When, as a child, she'd ask her adoptive parents about it, they'd reply in jokes. If it was around St. Patrick's Day, they'd tell her she was Irish. If it was a Polish holiday, they'd say she was Polish. Jean said that she used to be, as she put it, vehemently indifferent to being adopted, and insisted to others that she didn't have any interest in her natural family. But now that she was older, she felt that her vehemence had been necessary to cover up both her intense curiosity about her own parents and her anger at knowing nothing about them. Once she admitted her interest, she had so many questions. She had to have answers, even though her adoptive parents had said they were afraid of losing her if she found her mother, and her adoptive father was angry that it was even possible for her to search. He was of the opinion that all records should be burned. Jean said that she had always been the black sheep of her adoptive family, and wondered if, when she found her mother and learned about her biological family, her natural family, she would find a reason for this. She didn't feel that her adoptive family had ever understood her, and she reported a lot of conflict growing up. She believed that her adoptive mother had not been well suited to motherhood, but had adopted and raised two children because being a mother was the expected role of women. And her adoptive mother seemed much happier, she said, now that the children were grown and out of the house. I had never considered how difficult, how painful it would be to know nothing at all about where you came from. My daughter Lucy had sometimes asked me to retell the story of her birth, settling happily near me to hear it all over again, and she could see on our walls at home the photographs of her grandmother, great-grandmother, and great-great-grandmother, all of whom she resembled. Though my son Matt was legally adopted by my second husband, he knew his natural father, and when he was older saw him and his half-siblings at times. But Jean knew nothing at all. She resembled no one in her adoptive family. Her adoptive parents were infertile, as, indeed, they had been required to prove with a medical certificate in order to adopt her. Then they adopted another child a few years later. Jean told me she sometimes felt she had come from another planet. While I prepared what information I was permitted to give to Jean, I began trying to find her mother, Emily, by following up the addresses she had so carefully sent to the adoption agency over the years. I hunted fruitlessly through telephone books for one address on the East Coast, apparently the name of an organization. Later, Emily and I would realize that the organization's name had been entered incorrectly into her file. If that had been the only lead, neither I nor anyone else at the agency might ever have found Emily. But luckily, the file told me what college Emily had attended, and luckily, that college had an updated alumni directory, which included her, and luckily, there was a friendly person at the alumni office willing to give me her address. I sent Emily a note on the agency letterhead stating that I had some important confidential information for her and asking her to call me. I was concerned that such an impersonal note would alarm her, but I was advised not to write more since I didn't know who might open the letter. Several weeks went by with no response. Emily must have moved, I thought, and left no forwarding address. Jean called me regularly to see if I was making any progress, and I was sorry each time to disappoint her. Finally, one Monday, there was a pink telephone message slip in my agency mailbox. Emily had called over the weekend and left her number with the agency's answering service. I dialed her number with trepidation. She answered at once, as though the phone was in her lap. I said, "The confidential information is that your daughter is looking for you." There was a big intake of breath at the other end of the receiver, then sobbing for many minutes. When finally she could speak, Emily told me that as a nurse, she'd had occasion to thump someone's chest to restart a heart. "This is what your words have done for me," she said, "restarted my heart after 25 years. I called Jean. She cried with the same intensity as her mother had. Jean told me later that when she drove her car to meet her mother and got a few feet from Emily's driveway, she nearly chickened out. "I was afraid she'd cry and I wouldn't, that I'd just stand there with no feeling. But as soon as I saw her, I started crying. She had to help me out of the car. We're so alike. We just looked and looked at each other. Her eyes seemed so familiar." And Emily told me, with serious eyes and tenderness in her voice, she let me hold her. It was quite a moment to hold my baby for the very first time.